From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. On this day in 1864, William Tecumseh Sherman began his march to the sea from Atlanta to Savannah. It was the beginning of a major blow to the Confederacy during the American Civil War. While the 19th century sounds like ancient history to some of us, there exists a tangible division in this country, which has this year played out in an emotional debate over how to treat Confederate monuments and statues. This month is also the 119th anniversary of the day a white mob seized the reins of government in Wilmington, drove out elected African American leaders, destroyed the local black-owned newspaper, and terrorized the African American community. November 10, 1898 marks the only known coup d'etat on American soil. Today we're meeting a man whose family has played a pivotal role in both North Carolina and Wilmington history. George Rountree III is a practicing attorney in the city of Wilmington. Throughout his life, he has donated to causes that support high poverty and minority communities, as well as victims of domestic violence and Wilmington's Miracle League Field. He has supported the work of the 1898 Commission, which was charged with creating an official history of that event. He has served as a state legislator in both the North Carolina House and Senate. George Rountree III is also the great-grandson of the last Attorney General of the Confederacy, George Davis, who is memorialized in a statue that stands near the corner of 3rd and Market Streets in downtown Wilmington. Today we meet him as he is in 2017, with his Confederate history, his contributions to local causes, and his open admissions that he's more comfortable with people who look and sound like him. George Rountree, welcome to Coastline.
Rachel, thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me to be here, and I'm happy to talk candidly about what I think.
It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, ma'am.
And that was one of the draws of speaking with you by phone was how candid you are, how direct you are. And you, of course, our listeners, are invited to join this conversation. If you have a question for George Rountree, you can reach us during this live Wednesday edition by calling 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. George Rountree, as I said in the introduction, your family has had a tremendous amount of influence on both the city of Wilmington and the state of North Carolina. In broad strokes, what elements would you identify part of our lives today that exist here because of your family?
It's difficult for me to be self-serving, and I don't want the comments to sound that way, but
think of this as a history, an oral history.
I firmly believe that the family has been a family of moderation, in many things, and at the same time has been at a positive end of assisting in developing relationships among people. We live in a world of people. People are more important than things. If you identify with that, if you agree with that, then you'll begin to understand why my wife Sylvia and I have done the things that we've done. There are three kinds of givers, Rachel. One is the giver who expects a quid pro quo. There's got to be something back right away. Number two, there's the giver who believes that in giving, he has created an environment where someone's going to give back to him and he's looking forward to it in the future. And the third is the person who gives because of the joy he or she feels in making things better for other people. And it's the last of those which I hope our family is depicting.
Your grandfather, Robert Hart Rountree.
Great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather. One point, he offered the governor of North Carolina money to raise a regiment, as you put it.
That's correct.
And the governor turned down that offer. Tell us why.
The governor said, Robert, we're going to have other people do what you've just offered to do. You have superior organizational ability on the business side, and we need someone in North Carolina to manage the manufacture of shoes for the Southern Army, Confederate Army. And so that's what he did. And at the end of the Civil War, April of 1865, there were enough shoes in storage in Charlotte and Raleigh to put new shoes on every Confederate soldier.
Your family history is steeped in the tradition of slavery and owning plantations, and your family had cotton and tobacco interests. And,
no question.
And there were that success was contributed to by slaves.
Correct.
How do you process that now when you look at the wealth built? Is that part of what drives your philanthropic efforts today?
I haven't directed any relationship between the two, and maybe there is one that I just don't perceive, haven't considered. What I do know is Robert Hart Roundtree, my great-grandfather, was a slave owner, a cotton farmer of significant size in Pitt County, and in the area surrounding Pitt County. And he, according to my father's older sister, told my father's older sister that the cotton gin made slavery obsolete in 1837 when it was invented by Eli Whitney, and he began expanding his interest into exporting cotton. And after all his property had been confiscated by the federal authorities and all the slaves freed, he, with friends from Charleston and Savannah and Norfolk, went to New York and formed the New York Cotton Exchange, which is a major undertaking.
Were the slaves freed before the end of the Civil War? Your family's slaves?
Yes. What I know, my grandfather was given three slaves when he was 8 years old, 1862. And one of them was to take care of his clothes, and one of them was to take care of his horses, and the third was to take care of his guns. In 1880 or so, my grandfather and the oldest child of George Davis, my grandmother Meta, were in Richmond, where he was working in business. And he was having dinner, and he was told by the manager of the hotel where they were staying that there were three people in the kitchen wanting to talk to him. And he went there and found the three black men who had been
his slaves.
His slaves. And they were then gospel singers who were en route from Atlanta, Georgia to London to put on a concert. And they had a warm meeting, and he invited them out and sat at his table, and that was the last time he saw them.
And they were traveling at that point as free men.
Yes, they were.
When you think about your ancestors, your great-grandfather and your grandfather, and the way they thought about slaves, it's hard for someone in the 21st century, I think, to enter that mindset, to understand how one human being can look at another human being as an object, as someone who is not entitled to determine his own destiny, as someone that can be owned by someone else and direct it. It's just hard to get into that thinking. Can you help us with that? Because it doesn't sound like you vilify your great-grandfather in your own mind. You don't think of him as an evil person.
No, I don't. And maybe I'm looking at it through colored lenses. I don't know. I can't answer that question. What I know of no instance in which a slave was maltreated or mistreated. I know of no instance in which my great-grandfather ever sold a slave, period. I know of no instance in which he ever caused the mother of a child born in slavery to be separated from her child. And I've inquired about that, particularly of my Aunt Mita, who was my father's oldest sibling. And she, of course, had gotten stories from Robert Hart Roundtree, from her father. And none of what I've described as far as the worst things that could occur in slavery occurred so far as I know. Now, slavery is bad, period. The idea that one person can dominate another is bad. Now, that happens in domestic violence cases. And my wife and I have been very involved with that.
Which is a cause that you contribute to, yes. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. George Roundtree III is with us today. We're exploring his family history, which includes slaves, plantations, and the last Attorney General of the Confederacy. We're learning about how he thinks about his own history, and he's taking your questions on this live Wednesday edition. You can call us today at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. George Roundtree III is a Wilmington attorney who started his practice in the 1960s. He's also a contributor to local causes supporting victims of domestic violence, communities of color, and local educational institutions. And he's the great-grandson of the last Attorney General of the Confederacy, George Davis, whose statue stands at the entrance to downtown Wilmington on 3rd and Market Streets. And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question for George Roundtree, you can call us during this live Wednesday edition at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. George Roundtree, during the break, you were telling me about the woman who raised you. Tell us about her. What was her name? And this was a woman who was African-American. She has now passed.
She was an African-American. She has now passed. Her name was Mary Lily Fields. And she lived over on, I think, South 8th or South 9th Street. But here was a woman who carried me around. She made sure I was fed. She made sure that I took the naps I was supposed to. She made sure that I got what I apparently wanted at the particular time. I didn't learn to talk. I didn't walk until I was about 3 because she carried me around every place that she thought I needed to be. And she just had a feeling for what I meant when I said, That somehow meant something to her. And she got that something, and that was satisfying. And we had a very close relationship. I would regard her as a surrogate mother.
And you took care of her until she passed. I'm sorry. You would have gone to school before schools were desegregated. Tell us about your interactions with people of other races before college, because I know there's a friendship that you developed in college.
first place, I went to grammar school here in Wilmington at Isaac Bear till third grade, through the third grade, and then Forest Hills from 4 to mid-8. Mother moved my sister and me to Phoenix, where her mother then lived in 1947, and I spent the second semester of 8th grade there, and then high school and college, then law school in Arizona. Now, Phoenix Union High School system was the only segregated system in the entire state of Arizona at the time. Now, it's integrated, but then it was totally segregated. So it wasn't until I got to college and was on a basketball and athletic scholarship, and one of my contemporaries was a black man, black fella, who was a great player, Haiti Red. After he left the University of Arizona, he went to San Francisco, was head of detectives there for a while. He died 2 or 3 years ago.
And this was a friendship that you maintained. He came to family Thanksgiving dinners growing up.
Yeah.
Was that strange for your family during a time when you socialized probably only with white people?
Well, it may be strange for me, but it was not strange to my mother.
Why is that?
Well, mother was a Massachusetts born. Her father graduated from Worcester Tech, died of a heart condition when he was vice president of Northern Pacific Railroad, headquartered in St. Paul. And he had been commissioned by the United States government at the request of Russia and China to approve the design and manage the construction of the Trans-Siberian Railroad. In fact, he and my grandmother were in Petersburg when the Tsar was assassinated. They were good friends of the Tsar's regime. All documented pretty carefully, and the documentation been given to Stanford University and Arizona State University in Tempe.
And so what was you said it was your mother's interface with people of other races that was not strange?
A mother knew no color.
And why is that? Was it just her worldliness or her education?
It was a combination of a number of things. Her parents, the way she was taught growing up. She went to Radcliffe when Radcliffe was not part of Harvard but was separate, one of the 7 college conference schools. Was Phi Beta Kappa graduate. Liked people. Her last job was working for the American Red Cross in Phoenix, helping the veterans in the Korean War, early 50s, make contact with their families when a family issue arose. A very, very strong, people-oriented person.
You're listening to Coastline. My guest today is attorney, philanthropist, and civic leader George Rountree III. He's also the great-grandson of the last attorney general of the Confederacy, George Davis, who is honored with a statue at the entrance to downtown Wilmington on Market Street. You can ask your own question of George Rountree during this live Wednesday discussion, either by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us today at coastline@whqr.org. Andy from Whiteville, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me, and thank you, Mr. Rountree, for this open discussion. But I'm a pastor, and I'm an African-American pastor, and I'm trying to understand how you reconcile owning your folks owning human beings. And when the question was asked whether or not that motivated you in your philanthropy, you said that there's probably no direct connection. I'm wondering how, and then there was another follow-up question about your thoughts of your grandparents and great-grandparents involved in that. How can you not have remorse that you had family members that owned people, no matter where they were given or whether they were, maybe even it sounded like since they were not doing the atrocious things that we know about, that it seems like there's no remorse that people were owned by other people. And I'll listen on the radio. Thank you so much, though, for sharing.
Thanks for calling in, Andy.
The two basic questions that I heard, number one, how do I reconcile the owning people? And I don't. Mm-hmm. It's very simple.
Yeah.
I don't. In the history of this country, cheap labor was essential to the growth of the economy in the South. Europe, particularly London and England, needed cotton. And the South provided a medium from which to acquire that cotton. To grow cotton at that time, there was no cotton gin, required manual labor. And that probably was beneath a lot of white folks. Do I find that abominable? Of course. Can I explain it? Only by the economies that developed at the time. Now, the second essential question, as I understand it, was how do you possibly deal with the history of your family in regard to slavery without feeling remorse? I believe that's the thrust of it.
Yes.
And I do have some remorse, just as I have remorse about the way Native American Indians were treated, and just as I have a feeling about how any human being who's being abused by another, how we as civilized people can allow that to continue. So the answer is, I can't reconcile, and I do have remorse. I try to funnel the product of the remorse to doing things that I can help, because I can't change history. I mean, that's the reality. And so what is the next best thing to me? And that is help disenfranchised kids arise from the ashes as the phoenix and become productive members of the community. I've often said that if a man and a woman have stakes in society, they're going to refer to the police as the police, not cops. And when the trouble arises, they're going to call the police or 911 and not call a gang member or call someone to exacerbate the anger that has produced the ill will and bad result.
We have an email from Jim who asks, is there a written record of the names and ages of the slaves owned by the Roundtree family, either at the end of the Civil War or at any other time before that?
If there is, I don't know about it and have asked. What I remember of my grandfather is being mesmerized early in the morning when I spent the night with him and my grandmother by going into his bedroom and crawling on top of his bed and being told stories of Greek mythology. And stories of English heroism. He was a great Anglophile. I thought that if the Court of King's Bench had not ruled on something, it had ever come up. So he and I never talked about that. Now, he required me to memorize the names of the presidents from Washington to Franklin Roosevelt, forwards and backwards. So in marched me down Front Street to the Royal or the Bijou, which were the local theaters where the Lone Ranger was played. He would stop somebody and say, I want you to hear my grandson tell you the names of the presidents. And he'd tap me on the shoulder with his cane, I'd perform.
And so how did you learn about your family history as it relates to before the Civil War, slavery, plantations, and then 1898, which we'll get to?
I would say almost exclusively from my Aunt Meta. Meta Davis Rountree, who's the daughter of Meter Alexander Davis Rountree. She lived to be 99, a delightful person. Spent her last years in Chapel Hill, and she regaled a number of stories about the family and what happened, what shouldn't have happened, what could have happened and didn't. So the answer to the question directly is Aunt Meta.
Mm-hmm. When you and I first spoke, and we talked about this before we went live today, we spoke by phone, and your first reaction to me was you were angry. And you said to me, at what point, and I'm paraphrasing, this is not a quotation, but it was something like, at what point will I have done enough? I contribute to this cause and that cause. You specifically mentioned, I think, the Boys and Girls Club and some of these other charitable causes that have meant a lot to you.
Kids Making It, communities in schools, Boy Scouts.
Jim asks a follow-up question. Do you feel that your family's done enough financially and socially to repair the damage done during the 1898 coup d'etat?
Well, that question assumes the damage has been rectified.
Excellent point.
And I don't know that it has. But the
what evidence do you still see of the damage from the 1898 coup d'etat?
I see the lack of a system of education that will permit people from disenfranchised families, and they can be of any color, to compete in a very competitive educational and economic world. Whether we like it or not, competition is not limited to Monday night football. It is out there everywhere. That is a reason why Sylvia and I have given quite a bit of money for years to the law school at the University of Arizona law students who have come out of depressed environments who've been athletes as undergraduates. They may be runners or swimmers or football players, whatever. Also out here at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, we've helped.
Does it trouble you that the public school system in New Hanover County has kind of resegregated, and many of the high poverty schools are also high minority schools and lower performing schools? Is that something that concerns you, and do you think that is a result of what happened in 1898?
Yes, it concerns me. And the reason it concerns me is because it tends to aggregate students from the same sort of environment, which is a difficult environment, into an academic environment where these students are expected to listen, to comprehend, and to develop a feeling that what they've heard and what they've understood and comprehended has significance to their lives as successful members of society. So that's clearly important. Do I have an answer for that? Yes, I do, but that's another subject.
What's the answer, briefly?
First place, I think that the efforts by governmental authorities to focus importance upon test results and scores is a bad mistake. Number one, it invites fraud. It disincentivizes somebody from maximizing what I call common sense. The garden of failure is filled with intelligence. There is no common sense in the garden of failure.
Do you think that racial segregation has anything to do with the failure here? Is bridging the racial divide a factor in your mind in moving towards a solution for with schools that are currently failing?
I think the answer to that is yes, but busing is an issue. And so how does one accommodate that?
Is part of this a deeper issue then with just the basic racial divide that exists between white people and people of color in Wilmington? I mean, is there a deeper issue here? Is this school situation just representative of the way folks feel?
Well, the answer to your question is yes, there's a deeper issue. And I think if we look back in the 1967, 68, Williston was closed. Everybody.
And that's the music that means we're going to break. I'll let you continue that history when we come back. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking with George Rountree III. After this break, you'll have one more segment to call in with your question, 910-343-1138 or coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You are listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're learning today about what it means to carry a legacy of association with the Confederacy and living in the 21st century. George Rountree III, recipient of the Star News Media Lifetime Achievement Award in 2016, is with us today. He has spent his career as an attorney. He served as a state legislator in both chambers of the General Assembly. If you have your own question for George Rountree on this Wednesday, there are two ways to get it to us. You can either email us at coastline@whqr.org or call us at 910-343-1138. Just a reminder, this is the last segment, so you only have a few minutes left. Just before we went to break, George Rountree, I asked you about whether the resegregation of schools in this area in this time is representative of a deeper, more troubling division, and not just a result of mechanics that it's shaken out that way. And you started to talk about Williston in the 1960s, which was a school here in Wilmington, is now today.
Yes. Now, back then, and before 1967, it was a high school and a junior high school. And the high school and the junior high school taught wood shop, bricklaying, plumbing skills, electric skills, HVAC skills, and skills that physical labor could do and exceed expectations and make a good living and become a member of society that had a stake. And so you remember I said something about that earlier.
You did.
People with stakes in society are looking for control by honorable policemen. They're looking for opportunity to have their voices heard in political discussions and debates. And they insist that they should have a role in determining a policy. And, well, they should.
You also said, and right now you're talking about vocational options,
right.
and that's certainly something that I think local leaders here have been focusing on with the new career and technical high school that is opening up, and that is something that's been very much on the radar of educational officials. But what about that racial divide? What is that a gap that we need to bridge? Is that part of the lingering effect of not just the 1898 coup d'etat that ousted elected black leaders from office and burned down the black-owned newspaper and terrorized the black community, but earlier than that.
And defied the federal government to intervene.
That's right. Is this racial division that we see evidence of today here in Wilmington, is that something that we need to work towards bridging?
Certainly the answer is yes. Now, how to go about that is a more demanding question, a deeper subject. There are a number of things that determine one's personal posture in life. If one can imagine a pie chart, where do you live? What does your father do? Do your parents both live in the house where you do? Where do you go to school? What language do you speak? What clothes do you wear? Do you have regular time for eating, studying, and sleeping? If you can imagine each of those plus more as components of this pie chart, then you begin to get an understanding that there are many factors that determine with whom you associate and how well the association works. It seems to me that we're focused on trying to affect changes of thought patterns that have been ingrained for decades.
Whose thought patterns?
I think both black and white. And now whether Mexican nationals are here or in a separate thought pattern, I don't know.
You have observed before that you're more comfortable with people who look like you and sound like you and dress like you and enjoy the same things socially that you would enjoy. And I think that's human nature. I think that's probably true for most
right.
people in one way or another.
Right.
And,
right.
and, you know, hence these cultural differences that you're identifying. Do you think that it's worth the effort for people, white people, people of color, people of any ethnicity, to lean into the discomfort with other cultures and ethnicities in the interest of trying to bridge gaps?
Or Rachel, I do, provided the leaning in is in earnest, is not just part of some intellectual discourse or discussion for the day. Whether you're trying to understand the pressures and issues confronting people who've never had the opportunities. My father told me once that he perceived that one day I wanted to be wealthy enough to give money away if I acknowledged I did. And he gave me a book entitled The Challenge of Abundance. And there are different pressures and issues that confront one when one's earning capacity exceeds the needs required by that person. And being able to make the decisions on a sound basis that enable you wisely to use that which you've been given. As Mother said, of those who have much, much is expected. And she meant that in every sense of the words.
We heard earlier from Rochelle in Burgaw asking, what's your best creative idea that can fix the future of education? Where do we go from here?
My best idea, most creative idea, is composed of three facets, three tranches, if you will. Number one, We have got to entice into the teaching profession those who are the most capable of imparting thoughts in a fashion that the listener will consume. One can be the most knowledgeable person in the world, but if your method of imparting that knowledge and information discourages the listener from hearing you, you're not worth anything. How to attract and pay those people significantly more. And then number two is giving the parent of the grammar school kids particularly the opportunity to choose the best teacher for their child. You're going to find out pretty dadgum quickly who's the best teacher. And that word gets out. Who's the teacher who calls mama and says, your child did not appear to be well today, just wanted you to know about it? Who's the teacher who calls mama and says, your child needs a little help with geometry? Now, the third thing, the trilogy, is mama or grandmama has got to be focused on making that child the best that child can be until that child is capable of understanding his own responsibility or her own responsibility in that equation.
We're talking with George Rountree III, local attorney, philanthropist, civic leader, also the great-grandson of the last Attorney General of the Confederacy, George Davis, who is memorialized with a statue at the entrance to downtown Wilmington on Market Street. You can ask your own question of George Rountree during the live Wednesday discussion by calling 910-343-1138 or emailing us today at coastline@whqr.org. Have a couple of emails I want to get to. But first of all, the George Davis statue that's on Market Street near the intersection with 3rd. We've heard from people who historians have pointed out on this show, on Coastline, that those types of statues were erected to affirm white supremacy and to intimidate people of color and remind them. I mean, this was a statue that was erected in the early 20th century. Do you believe that that statue should stay in the public square, or do you think it would be appropriate to move that statue to, say, a museum or some other kind of historical institution?
The question is, ask me what I think is better for the harmony of the community.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, not what I personally feel.
Well, tell us both. Is there a divergence there?
There probably is somewhat of a diversion. I think that George Davis, whose oldest child was my grandmother, and whom I remember very favorably, was a moderation leader. He did not support secession. He did not support taking up arms against the country into which he'd been born in 1820 and which had afforded him an opportunity to make a good living as a lawyer and to be a successful member of the community with a stake in society in southeastern North Carolina. Now, once secession became a reality, he was in a difficult spot, and if I look back and say, all right, what would I have done? Probably the same thing he did, which would have made me wrong in the eyes of history, and that would have been just the way it was.
You're saying you understand the circumstances, you understand the historical context of the question confronting him, and right. You don't fault him for making the choices that
right.
he made.
And it was not about slavery. There's a huge argument among historians about the cause of the Civil War. The cause of the Civil War was states' rights versus federalism.
Wasn't it states?
That was
the right
brought into focus by Dred Scott decision and John Brown's actions at Harper's Ferry and a number of things. And that had been, since the Missouri Compromise of 1820, that had been evolving.
Is calling the conflict states' rights versus federalism not somehow an obfuscation of the fact that it was a fight about the right of certain states to own people? I mean, isn't that really what it is?
I would say that that is another way of describing it. Depends upon whether one is a theoretician or whether one is looking at the practicality of things.
Okay, so
if you're looking at the practicality, yes, it's slavery. If you're looking at the theory of federalism, keeping in mind that the United States is the only country in the world that has a constitution based upon a Declaration of Independence, which embodies early in its recitation the nationalism, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands. And the second sentence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they're entitled by their creator with certain, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights.
Yes. So given that, and given your understanding of the circumstances surrounding George Davis's participation in the Confederacy, today, in 2017, do you, and I'm not asking you to say George Davis was a villain, but what I am asking is there's a recognition that that statue was erected during a time of the reemergence of white supremacy. I'm not sure it entirely went away. I don't think it has. But there was that. There was the push to establish the inferiority of African Americans. And in light of that, does it make sense to keep a symbol of that movement in the public square?
Well, that's a question that begs the answer of no.
You think it should be moved? You think the George Davis statue should be moved?
If the effect of my great-grandfather's statue at 3rd and Market is, as you have described, disruptive and meaningfully negative, then I think of something ought to be done about that. Where should it be? To where should it be moved? I don't have a thought about it. It's that question puts me in conflict with personal thoughts, primarily from my grandfather, my grandmother. I mean, my grandmother was about 5 feet one, about 98 pounds. But when she walked in the room, she was the queen bee. Nobody started eating at the dinner table until she picked up her fork. And when she put her fork down, everybody stopped.
We just have a minute left. If you could leave members of this community with one important understanding about who George Rountree is today and what his legacy says about him, what would that be?
I would hope there would be a person who recognized the importance of people. People are more important than things, and that the focus of the state and this community should be upon inducing everyone to take a person for what he or she is worth.
That's this edition of Coastline. George Rountree, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Associate producer is Rachel Keith. Production assistant is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast or find it on the HQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.